listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2026 Vuelta a España. On the ground and on the road, from Monaco to Granada.
Precisamente en el año 2023, ha ganado etapas en el Gran Premio de las Naciones también en 2023.
This is you in your element. This is exactly the kind of place I would expect you to hang out in front of the casino in Monte Carlo. The Vuelta started. We've had some logistical problems today. Listeners have heard that before on the Cycling Podcast. But we thought we would get here for the first rider going off about an hour ago. We're not, but we are here for an Italian going off. We're going to listen to Busato.
Francisco Busato, Valverde just started his Vuelta a España, an important Grand Tour for him, by the way. But, Daniele, we are under the sun. We just came up from the iconic Fairmont hairpin. It's the notorious hairpin bend that the Formula One track does in Monte Carlo. And the casino is right in front of us. Sun is out. The sky is blue, amazing atmosphere.
I mean, it feels very Monte Carlo. This is everything that Monte Carlo and Monaco would have dreamed of when they decided they wanted to hold the Vuelta a España. I mean, it looks, not necessarily a place that I would come to. But it looks splendid, doesn't it?
I've never seen so many supercars in my life. I saw a pink Ferrari, a purple Maserati and stuff. It's crazy. Daniele, important time trial today for the Vuelta a España. And to start off, we are waiting for the big names that are coming later today.
No, Panacci. The time, Panacci.
Let's see, Daniele. Update. Oh, he's seventh!
Oh, wow.
Far behind.
Seventh. Heiter looks like he's going to get the first red jersey. Panacci, I'm speaking from memory here. I think the last British rider, not English, to take the red jersey, first ever Vuelta a España, Peter Kenyuk. I haven't used internet for this. In 2016 in Galicia, team time trial, Sky won it. I think Ethan Hayter's got a great chance. We've got, Pogacar's probably got 2 kilometres to go. Two down, 2 seconds down, or 3 seconds down at the first time check. What do you think? Is he going to do it?
It's tough. I think Pogacar can do it. He has to take risks in the second half of this circuit, which is the most technical, most turns. The final is very tricky.
Sounds like you're giving Tadej Pogacar advice here. He's giving Pogacar's top tips for success in professional cycling.
If he listens to me, he will win. If he doesn't, lose.
And Pelacci, just before he gets here, describe the scene here, because you were telling me earlier, and we're going to rely on you throughout this episode for any Formula One references, because I know nothing, as you've established, about Formula One. And you were saying that this part of today's Vuelta a España time trial circuit is a famous part of the Formula One circuit.
It's one of the most iconic places in Formula One, because we are on the start line of the Monaco Grand Prix, which is not straight. Most of the Grand Prix is starting a straight, long line. This is not.
Here he comes, he's come out of the line. The TV's about 3 seconds behind Pelacci. What do we think? Has he got it? I'm going to suggest not. The scores are in, the riders are in, Roglic is in. Can you confirm the final result for me of this? It's not a prologue. It's the first stage of the Vuelta a España. Who's in the red jersey? Not an Englishman.
I think. Listen, Daniele, for all we know, Tadej Pogacar is the first red jersey. Pogacar's doing it.
Hang on, is Alex Kirsch in yet? Do we know what his time was?
Far behind.
It
was not my best prediction,
oh,
I must admit.
Things can only get better, as a famous song once said. Hermes, Valentino, Gucci.
Wow.
These are the names that I think of when I think of you, Michele Pelacci. You're in the same conversation. That name, Pelacci, it evokes notions of luxury, prestige, just like those brands.
Daniele, io queria avere un pochito de verdadero real ciclismo.
Oh God.
Estamos aquí por esto,
Here we go.
Here for
Pelacci, very good. I see you've been working on your Spanish, but good evening first of all. Welcome to the Vuelta a España. The listeners have already heard a little bit of about our day. It was a chaotic day, as these days often are, when we sort of lulled into a false sense of security and leisure. I think it was leisure being the operative word today, because it was a late start. Of course, we arrived at the start in Monaco very late, too late. And we paid the price, didn't we, later on in the day. But more of that, or maybe not, later. Michele, just describe the scene. I've already alluded to the fact that we are sitting on a sort of corniche. There are many corniches in this part of the world, above the Mediterranean. And in front of us, we've got some of the lovely boutiques that Monaco specializes in. Hermès, Valentino, Gucci. Can you tell us a little bit more about where we are,
Michele? Yeah, we are very close to the route of the Formula One circuit in Monte Carlo. We just came up the Santa Devote. That's the first big right turn that, the tracks and Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, all of those guys do every year. And we are surrounded by skyscrapers, rich palaces. We are on the harbor as well, where many yachts are, where the full moon is coming up. And half moon, you say that? Half moon?
Yes.
And the luna?
Yes.
And everything looks brilliant. We are under the sky.
We're usually under the sky.
Yeah, but it's a blue sky. It's a very pristine day, I must say.
Indeed. But actually, we've felt very poor today, haven't we?
Oh, yeah.
In these very, very salubrious surroundings that aren't really befitting of two scruffs like us. But anyway, it has been a really interesting day. Monaco shown off to its best effect, the weather they would have dreamed of when they first bid for this Vuelta a España start. I got pulled up earlier in the week, Pelacci, after the preview. I think I had a bit of a slip of the tongue. I wanted to say that Monte Carlo was the first city that had held the starts of all three major tours. I think it came out, I said it was the first city to hold all three major tours. Of course, there are other places like Utrecht in the Netherlands and Turin, which has held now, as of a couple of years ago, it's held all three major tours. But Monaco, or Monte Carlo, is the first city to have held, and now it has held, it's the past tense, it's happened, the starts of all three major tours. So history was made today in some fashion. We knew that was going to be the case. And history was made in the Korea, in the Stella, and still becoming more Stella, Korea of Tadej Pogacar, because it was his first red jersey. It was his first, the first time he's led the Vuelta a España today.
Daniele, I think this was his 20th win of the season in 37 race days. This is unbelievable. And the way he did it, he won because he wanted to win. He didn't have to, again. But he's such a competitor. And he said, when he's challenged, he gives his best. And he said, I got this.
Pelacci, we're going to, of course, analyze the stage in more detail in part two. That's what we traditionally do in the Grand Tours. Part two is the part that we dedicate to the analysis of the stage. But one thing that caught my eye in the run-up to the race and interviews that he did, I think at the team presentation, which was on Thursday, we weren't here for that, but he talked about how he was going to approach this Vuelta a España. And this was something that Larry and I discussed in the preview episode. We wondered whether he would start hot, red hot, and try to finish it, get it over with, or get the general classification done and dusted early on, and then sort of cruise into the last sort of half of the race. What we saw today suggested that might indeed be the case. But he also said at the team presentation, I mustn't finish this race cooked finish, because I have to think about the objectives that I've got later on in the year. And of course, we know he's going to the World Championships. We know he's going to the Tour of Lombardy. So maybe mixed messages. We haven't heard his interview after the finish today yet. But Pelacci, should we, without further ado, should we skip ahead to that first hamonometro? Feels like a big moment of this Vuelta a España.
El jamonómetro de Michele Pelacci.
Pelacci, before you give us your grade for tonight, it feels like an opportune moment to remind listeners that you are the heir to a vast jamon empire, or prosciutto empire, in the centre of Italy, in Parma. Hence why we decided to restyle a couple of years ago, once you sailed into the cycling podcast orbit on one of those yachts, much like the ones we're looking over at the moment. We thought that it would be opportune and a fitting homage to you to rechristen what used to be the tail of the tappa, the jamonometro. And you get the opportunity here to give a grade, a number of jamones, hams, prosciutti, it is jamones in this case, because we are going to be in Spain, to the stage. So how exciting, how good was today's stage out of cinco jamones?
I thought, mostly skeptical about time trials, I have to go for four. I have to go for four today because it was tense until the end. We had many changes in the leading seat. I loved today's stage, Daniele. And when the best rider in the world is challenged by several athletes, he was challenged by the likes of Van Aert, Ethan Hayter, Joshua Tarling, and all different sorts of riders. That's interesting to me. They were able to create a parcours that sort of made everyone challenging for everyone else.
Four Jamones for Pellacci. You mentioned the parkour there. You were very excited about it because it did reprise some of the iconic stretches of the Formula One circuit. I didn't know anything about that. You were schooling me today, Pellacci, in an unusual reversal of roles today about the circuit. Where were we earlier? The hairpins?
It's called the Fairmont Hairpin.
Okay.
It's pretty famous because it's downwards.
Yeah.
And many crashes happen there.
Mm.
There is an Ayrton Senna plaque that homages him.
Mm.
Yeah, it's pretty famous, Daniele. And it's iconic, the photos from the above. But all the turns actually here are pretty famous. You go from the Rascas to, you name it, Sainte Devote, Beau Rivage. The Grand Hotel Hairpin, as it's called sometimes, Mirabeau,
Tabac. You said there's an Ayrton Senna monument somewhere?
Exactly. And we were passing by another monument with the guy in the car in the first turn, Sainte Devote. I couldn't read much about it, but yeah, lots of Formula One history around here.
Exciting. Pellacci. It was an interesting course. We got an interesting time trial, a challenging time trial. We thought we might get some strange results today. We thought we might get some unusual names at the top of the leaderboard. We did to a certain extent. We've already established that Pogacar won, but tell us what else happened today, please.
9.4 kilometers of an individual time trial through the streets of Monaco. Diego Uriarte of Kern Pharma was the first rider at the start. He did so around 4 p.m., giving birth, I think, Daniele, to Kern Pharmismo.
Oh, no.
Is this where we're going today? Instead of Bardianismo? No Bardiani at the Vuelta a España.
Mm.
So Kern Pharmismo is the new...
I'll allow it. Only because our very good friend and old colleague, and hopefully he'll be a future colleague again, Fran Reyes, who used to do the podcast at the Vuelta a España, he currently works for Kern Pharma. And as we know, they're probably going to shut down, unfortunately, at the end of the year. But as a sort of nod to Kern Pharma's last Vuelta a España, we're going to allow this phenomenon, this nascent phenomenon that you've just created of Kern Pharmismo.
Then Alexander Pastel and Matthew Brennan set early fast times. Arthur Clockers and Oscar Chamberlain gained some time on the hot seat as the provisional leaders at some point. But then the kids started to fire all cylinders. Léo Bizieux set the fastest time. Callum Thornley set the fastest time as well. And we have to get used to these names in Grand Tour Ciclismo. Joshua Tarling, after a few minutes, was the first rider to go above 50 kilometers per hour on this tricky route and set the fastest time as well at one crucial point in the race. Three riders from Great Britain were on the podium as TT Brit champ Ethan Hayter went 4 seconds faster than Tarling. And as soon as we thought that Hayter was going to do it, Tadej Pogacar said, nope, I'm the champ here. He was a few seconds behind Hayter at the first intermediate point, but in the end, he came up victorious for a tenth of a second on Hayter. Is there anything this guy can do?
No, and I refer to him... Well, probably. But as far as cycling is concerned, not so much. Pellacci, I referred to him earlier, making history, his first red jersey in the Vuelta a España. We wondered as we were walking up here, the Zampelotto to where we're currently recording, whether there had ever been a closer run, first stage or time trial for a Grand Tour, whether there had been a finer margin by which someone had taken the leader's jersey. We'll maybe have an answer for you on that tomorrow. We haven't had time to look it up this evening. But Pellacci, we'll give the results, then we'll dive in a little bit. Tadej Pogacar, stage winner, as you've already said, average speed of 51.507 kilometers an hour. Fast, but not supersonic, and that tells us something about the course, doesn't it? Actually, Ethan Hayter was second. Sudal Quickstep, Josh Tarling, we're going to talk more about him in just a moment after a horrendous, the worst imaginable week or 10 days that he's had for Net Company Ineos. He was third. Fourth, another British rider. There were three British riders in a row. Callum Thornley riding his first Grand Tour. Callum Thornley from Edinburgh, of course, of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. He was 5 seconds behind Pogacar. And then we had two French riders, Christophe Laporte of Visma Lisebike, 6 seconds down. Léo Bizio of Decathlon CMA CGM, 8 seconds down. Then Oscar Chamberlain, who you mentioned earlier, 9 seconds down. Wout van Aert, who was fancied by some people, he was 8th, 9 seconds down as well. And 9th, we had Finn Fisher-Black, another Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe rider, 10 seconds down. And 10th, we had Arthur Kluckers of Tudor Pro Cycling, 11 seconds down. More about him as well in just a moment. Hilachi, let's just go down and pick out some other names, because I said there was a little bit of confusion and conjecture about who might fare well on this course. We weren't quite sure. A lot of the usual names, the pedigree time trialists, they were mentioned. The likes of, for example, Stefan Kung, he was 12th in the end, 14 seconds down. Jay Vine, of course, the Australian time trial champion, he was 14 seconds down. Ivo Oliveira, he was a name that was mentioned by some of the tipsters. UAE rider, 14 seconds down as well. Mads Pedersen, I fancied today, 16 seconds down for Little Trek. Matthew Brennan, another explosive rider who we thought on those technical sections he would be fast out of the corners and he would do well as well. And he was in the hot seat for a while, but he was 16th in the end. Pelacci, some other names.
Daniele, what's depressing me the most about this day is the fact that the two major contenders to the Tadej Pogacar's reign here at the Vuelta a España, Richard Carapaz and Felix Gall. Carapaz was more than 30 seconds down, and Gall was 91st, 46 seconds down. That's a lot.
That is a heavy tariff. That is a very heavy tariff, particularly when Decathlon, we'll talk about this later, we'll talk about the teams that did well today, and Decathlon had some conspicuously very good results today. So I thought Gal would do much better than that, and I didn't think he would lose that much time, but maybe I'm naive. We'll pick out a few more theoretical GC contenders, shall we? Pelacci, Primoz Roglic, he was 24th today. Of course, Primoz Roglic, a local. He lives in Monaco. Talking about natives of Monaco, Victor Longhelotti of XCS Astana. We don't expect him to contend for the general classification. He was 29th, 26 seconds down. Oscar Onley, Pelacci, help me out with Onley. Where do you see him? We're going to hear about him in just a second.
106th, 50 seconds down. Not fantastic for Onley either.
No, that is also a lot. Other GC riders, Enric Mas.
The last GC rider at all, possibly, if he's doing it, was Mikel Landa, 166th time for Landani. Not great.
Enric Mas, 33 seconds down in 50th place. Pelacci, this morning you told me that L'Equipe had pretty much mimicked my star ratings in the preview, hadn't they, in the sense that they'd given, for the general classification, for the overall in this of Vuelta a España, they'd given Pogacar 5 stars, they'd given no one 4 stars, no one 3 stars, they'd given Felix Gal 2 stars?
2, and Carapaz 2 as well.
2, yeah. And then had they given Enric Mas 1? Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that prediction, forecast, if we can call it that, probably looks fairly accurate tonight. We wondered how much suspense we were going to get in this Vuelta a España, and for those who are very attached to the notion of suspense in Grand Tours, it wasn't a great start to the race, but it was a great start to the race for Tadej Pogacar. But actually, we're going to hear from a couple of people now about their day today. I mentioned Josh Tarling. Now, of course, pretty much I think all of the listeners will be familiar with the tragedy that befell his family. It was last Friday, wasn't it, at the Volta a Portugal? His brother Finley passing away after he was hit by a car that had strayed onto the course. Tarling, we understand, was always down to ride the Vuelta a España. Obviously, it would have been understandable, and maybe it would have seemed logical that he would have pulled out of this race in the circumstances, but no, he wanted to ride. and what a performance he did today, finishing third on a course which wasn't necessarily the most well suited to him, because it did explode. It did sort of favour the more explosive riders. He's obviously a big boy and good on less technical routes, although he's a technical rider as well. He was third, and we're going to hear from his team's, we call him the team manager these days, I forget what his actual title is, but it's Geraint Thomas, of course, very familiar voice and name to all of our listeners. And we're also going to hear from a gentleman who we'll be hearing from a lot over the course of the next 3 weeks, and that is, of course, the Motown Maestro, Lucky Larry Warbass of Tudor Pro Cycling Team. We're going to hear about his ride today. We're going to hear about the sort of foreground to this Vuelta a España for his Tudor Pro Cycling Team, which was the retirement of Julian Alaphilippe, of which more later. So here are Geraint Thomas and Larry. Well, Geraint, we thought that Josh might ultimately end up with the red jersey today, but I mean, first of all, a lot of surprise that he was here in the end. I guess there's obviously been a lot of sort of soul searching for him and for everyone on the team before the decision was made to bring him here this week.
Yeah, obviously, like, from very early on, he was saying he wanted to ride, but we were just like, look, just take a bit of time here. Like, there's no rush, there's no stress. We can delay everything, and he was still adamant, you know, that he wanted to come, and he just wants to get in the team, get in the day job, so to speak. And I think just only worry about bike racing, and, you know, have the team around him to just, yeah, back to the day job, and we're fully supporting with that. And so it's great to see him here, and that ride today was just phenomenal from him, really. Like, he can't even imagine what he's been sort of going through the last week, and so yeah, to come here and do what he did was super special. Yeah,
and correct me if I'm wrong, but it wasn't necessarily a course that really suited him.
Yeah, no, I think technically he's very good, so from that regard, but I think other guys are technically good as well, so I think it lacked a somewhere for him to really get the power down and really use that, you know, brute force that he's got. But yeah, you know, like, when we saw it from the start of the year, we always knew that, like, well, it was a pretty good opportunity for him. But then obviously since this last week, it was, from a performance side, it hasn't even been a thought to it. It's just like making sure he's, or giving him the most support we could as a person, you know, rather than from a performance side. And, you know, he came here and switched on from yesterday, and to, like I say, to dig that out of the bag was, impressive, because I think anyone that's done a prologue like that, you know, the running's pretty key, because such a big effort. Like, if you haven't done much the last few days, like, if, when you're fresh, it's hard, you know, to really go deep and do that. So, yeah, it just shows the class of him, you know, as a person and an athlete. So, yeah, couldn't be prouder.
And is it going to be a case this week of, as he maybe asked to keep things as normal as possible, or have you had to put some special kind of measures in place for you to help him emotionally?
No, it's just... Steve Peters is obviously at the end of the phone from that regard, and you know, Steve was involved in the whole decision making process of him coming here, and once he's here, yeah, it's about just sticking to as normal, you know, just be completely normal as we would be. Like, I think he knows that everyone is here for him and to support him, and then from then on it's just you know, if he changes his mind, you know, in a few days, and he wants to go home, then that's completely fine as well. But yeah, from a team's point of view, from a staff, from a rider, it's just, you know, we stopped for a coffee yesterday on the bikes, and, you know, he was just laughing and joking with the boys, and it's just about, that's what he wants. So that's what everyone's going to try to do.
And just last word on Oscar today, Geraint, did we learn anything about how he's come into this Vuelta?
No, I think he just he spooked himself a bit in the recon, I think, and he had a bit of a slip. So I think it was all about just get around it as safe as possible, and just, yeah, no point. You know, you can lose 15 seconds by going a bit too slow around corners rather than push it a bit, crash, lose a minute, and obviously be banged up as well. So it was certainly a conservative ride from him, but, you know, this Vuelta's got some of them most amount of climbing, I think, well, I wouldn't say ever, but I don't know exactly the numbers, but there's a hell of a lot of climbing, put it that way. So
58,000 metres, I think.
Exactly, yeah, so it's a lot. So it's all to play for. He's on his bike and all good.
Larry, you started in a casino. Was it all on black? Everything on black? Any gambling out there?
I didn't gamble too much, but just really tried to do my best. I mean, it's not really a parkour that suits me, but I mean, it's a cool course and nice race, and I actually felt good. So,
yeah, some interesting results. We thought there'd be some curious results. No crashes yet.
That's really good. Probably because when people think it's a dangerous course, they're a little bit more cautious, you know? And so I think probably people took a bit less risk than maybe if they just thought it was not risky at all, you know? So I think, yeah, I mean, riders sometimes are smart. And yeah, you know, also it's like the prologue, first stage of a long race. So, so yeah, I mean, also the roads are good. It's like, even though it was super technical and super fast in some parts, like, they were pretty good roads. And honestly, I mean, even though it was crazy technical, I think it was safe.
Couldn't help noticing when you were on your way to the start how popular you are in these parts. I don't think you'll be the most popular rider out there today, maybe more so than Pogacar.
Oh, probably not, but I'll take my fans where I can get them. So yeah, it's nice to race at home.
Well, Larry, we'll be talking to you a lot over the next 3 weeks, hopefully. Two quick ones. Arthur Kluckers, we saw him in the hot seat earlier. He's been dethroned.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's rooming with me, so obviously that's where the good legs come from. But no, super nice guy. Really good time trialist, super strong. So to be honest, I'm not surprised. Yeah, I mean, he was saying that he'd be super, super happy with the top 10. And I mean, I don't know how it's looking now, but I would assume it'll probably be in the top 10. So that's cool.
Good legs are contagious. That's good news. So hopefully I'll have some tomorrow by virtue of having spoken to you. Last one. The eve of the build-up to this race, your team, Alaphilippe, is obviously the big story. I spoke to Fabien earlier about it. He says they were surprised. Talk to me about the mood among the riders about this.
Yeah, it sounded like he didn't like your questions because he came into the bus afterwards. He looked a bit shell-shocked. So I didn't realize that Daniel Freeb was asking the hard-hitting questions. But, yeah, I mean, everyone's like, you know, I think everyone really loved racing with Alaphilippe. And everyone really likes him as a person. So, you know, it was really an honor and a pleasure to race with him for the last year and a half. And, you know, I think it's just cycling's changing. And, you know, he has a kid. I think he's just tired and ready to be done, probably, you know. So, I mean, I haven't talked to him personally, but I totally understand, you know. And so I think probably the tour was hard. He was probably thinking about stopping, and who knows. I mean, maybe he just, when he had to get back to training, maybe he was just like, you know what, I don't feel the motivation anymore. And he's someone who's like, I think if he's not motivated, you know, I think it's quite honorable to just say, hey, you know, I'm done. And, you know, I mean, most guys would just try to ride it out and take the paycheck. So, you know, I think, you know, he's a big champion and, you know, a really good human. So I just think, like, yeah, he was tired and probably, I mean, this is, I have to talk to him, but yeah. I think it's just, yeah, he was just decided he was done.
Well, we'll let you go, Larry. Finished on that bombshell that Cancellara didn't like my questions.
Yeah, hopefully it lets you interview him again.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.
This is Jenny Garth from 90210 OMG. HGTV is bringing back the 90s in a big way with Totally 90s House, a brand new renovation competition series that reunites some of your favorite television stars from the era for a showdown unlike anything you've seen before. Let's be honest, the 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. But the home design choices, well, that's a different story. Hosted by Jaleel White, this throwback competition sends two teams of your favorite 90s TV stars across America in search of homes frozen in time. Their mission? Find the two most dated houses they can and transform them into modern dream homes. Jodie Sweetin, Beverly Mitchell, Brian Austin Green team up against Matthew and Joey Lawrence, Melissa Joan Hart, and Keisha Knight Pulliam. Paired with HGTV mentors, they'll transform those outdated spaces into fresh, modern homes while keeping just the right amount of dope, nostalgic charm. Goodbye, honey oak cabinets, sponge painted walls, and glass blocks. Hello, 21st century dream homes. Totally 90s House Special Series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 central on HGTV.
Pelacci, you've just reminded me that Josh Tarling is the white jersey after today's first stage, and he'll wear that tomorrow. But what an emotional scene it wasn't. I mean, he managed to hold it together, but after the finish today, we were there in a bundle of journalists, and usually in these situations it's the people working for TNT, the broadcasters, who are charged with asking the first questions, and I think everyone feels, well, they feel terrible for him. They feel very empathetic towards him, and it's a difficult situation. It feels like an awkward situation for everyone, really. But he was certainly concentrated on the job today.
It will be interesting and sad at the same time to see how he reacts and how, for example, will he respond to any media, any press? Rightfully so. Rightfully so. He did not wait for anybody today. As soon as he finished his effort, he drank something given by his staff and went all the way immediately back. Fine, it's tough. Who will be the first journalist to ask him a question? Who will be? It's tough. In these occasions, doing our job is so complicated, and it's very like you just feel your heart is melting, right?
Yeah, and it feels so tawdry and kind of grubby to be. Look, we were all there. I mean, we were there. We sort of gravitated towards him as well, because you're kind of curious to see his reaction, and you're aware that it's a big moment, and we are there ultimately to tell a story, and consequently, it feels important to be there just to see how he does react when he comes over the line. But as you say, you also want to sort of leave him in his to his grief and to the process that he's going to go through over the next few weeks, or days, weeks, months, years.
And the fact that he has the white jersey, Daniele, he's stepping on the podium. Tomorrow he'll be on the first line when we set off from Monte Carlo. He can't put on a smiley face, right? Rightfully so. He can't. So it's all a bit of a intricate question, dilemma, right?
Pelacci, let's talk about the stage winner, a gentleman named Tadej Pogacar. Oh, yeah. happens to live in Monaco. Maybe that was the difference today. Huh. Maybe local course knowledge, as I said earlier. We haven't heard his interviews yet. But I definitely think that will have added to his motivation. And look, he will know these roads. I don't think these are necessarily roads that the riders who live here will sort of, well, they will factor into their standard training rides. You know, I think they venture into the hills behind Nice most of the time. They don't sort of, you know, just do circuits around Monaco. But it probably did help to a certain extent.
It's interesting because some of the roads they were doing today have to be done when the traffic is open on the opposite side, on the opposite way. So, Pogacar, Daniele, I mean, I got some records written down. This is his 36th Grand Tour stage win. 36 in all Grand Tours. This is something that has been pretty rare. This guy can win time trials. It became pretty popular in Italy. A debate. Can he win 15 stages at this. If he really wants to win it all, he can win 15 stages.
Well, I said 9, didn't I, at the start of the in the preview, and I'm not sure whether I included today's time trial in it. It was certainly, I think he had an outside chance. We felt he had an outside chance. That was his 10th time trial victory as a professional. I think they're all individual time trials. I'll just go over them, shall I? Two national championships in Slovenia, Tour de France stage 20, the most famous one, of course, Planche des Belles Filles in 2020. The following year, probably the most surprising one, Cholet in the Tour de France. That was a relatively long, flat time trial where he beat the likes of Stefan Kung or Wout van Aert. Another Slovenian national championships in 2023. Giro d'Italia stage 7 individual time trial in 2024. That was the time trial where Filippo Ganna was well ahead early on, but the stage finished up the climb in Perugia. And it was almost, I'm not going to say it was a mountain time trial, but it certainly was very hilly and hence suited him. Then time trial stage 21, the last time trial in 2024, starting from Monte Carlo, finishing in Nice, again almost a mountain time trial. Stage 13 of the Tour de France in 2025, that was Pierre Agoude, a mountain time trial, a real mountain time trial. Tour of Switzerland in 2024, that was maybe the most sort of similar to this one. It wasn't the most similar in length, but maybe most similar in the sense that we thought that some of the flat track bullies, the big rouleurs, would get the better of him there, but that wasn't the case. And that was a very close run thing as well. He won that, Pellacci, over Mathieu van der Poel by an even finer margin than he wanted. That was, I believe that was 0.04 of a second. And today was 0.09 of a second. Is that right? And then we get to today. But if I'm not mistaken, today is the shortest of the time trials, the 10 time trials that he's won as a professional, because we don't consider him a specialist in time trials, do we? I mean, these tags, these labels are kind of ridiculous in cycling. You know, often we'll get, I always used to think it was ridiculous that people used to say, oh, Lance Armstrong is not the controversial Lance Armstrong. He's not a climber. But he was by far the best climber in professional cycling. Just because he didn't look like a climber, he didn't look like Marco Pantani, it didn't mean he wasn't a climber.
Is Tadej Pogacar evolving to do the individual pursuit on the track?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
I think he's been asked before about going for the hour record, and I don't think that's something he'll ever do either.
Interesting. We couldn't see much of Pogacar because, you see, in Monaco, you got a lot of fans, you got a lot of complicacies of logistics. It's not easy to go to place to place. Pogacar, I could see from going to the start, as he was going from the bus area to the start line, he was one of the very few riders wearing an ice vest.
That was the difference, but it could have been the difference. 0.09 of a second. It could have been anything.
Yep. You remember at Giro d'Italia this year, Lorenzo Milesi forgot his ice vest on during the time trial. Could have been a problem.
Absolutely. Or I'm sure we saw Ethan Hayter get a corner wrong, didn't we? I mean, he went into, there's a part on the course, Pellacci, maybe you'll remember which part it is. There was a sort of mural or kind of a wooden sort of hoarding on a bend, and I don't know whether it's sort of a shop, I don't know whether it's a shop being renovated or something, and he definitely took the wrong line, and he sort of hesitated. That, without any doubt, I think, cost Ethan Hayter the red jersey. Hayter, who incidentally, I was there when he was being interviewed off the finish, I think you were as well, and he did refer to today's course. He did say it was a bit silly, it was a bit sort of fiddly, it was a bit finicky. He really enjoyed it because he's a massive fan of Formula One, and that was one reason, and he also enjoyed it because he rode extremely well. And he's a guy, I know our colleague Daniel Benson wrote about him a few days ago, the fact that he's out of contract. And he's a guy whose career has had a strange trajectory because he started off in his first 2 or 3 years, he looked as though he might even become a bunch sprinter. And then we became aware that he had this Achilles heel of he didn't really like sort of getting his elbows out and getting rough. And he's one of those riders who prefers to lurk at the back of the peloton, and it feels as though this has really hampered him. He's maintained his level in time trials over the last few years. In fact, he's won a lot of races at Sudal Quickstep in time trials, but there is maybe still a feeling that he hasn't necessarily lived up to all of the hopes that they had for him. But that was a great result for him today.
Fantastic result. He mentioned something that was interesting to me. All these turns, all these twisty parkours in Monaco, he had no time to look at his head unit. No time to look at his VATS, his power meter.
Couldn't check his phone. Couldn't check Twitter.
No,
WhatsApp.
You had to be. I mean,
maybe
super.
Maybe that explains why you take 5 hours to respond. 5 hours. That's on a very good day. Often it's 5 days to respond to my WhatsApp messages.
This is false.
You're constantly riding very technical time trials courses.
Of course, I am. But also a guy who did very well today was Alessandro Romele from Italy, from Iseo. And he said that he's a big Formula One guy. He was naming all the turns by heart that was doing, and yeah, that are part of the Formula One
what
circuit.
What do you think, Pelacci, on the Formula One thing and the Formula One references? I hate, it makes me cringe. It's like nails on a blackboard, we say in English. This whole trend, this whole Gen Z, I'm blaming your generation, trend of P1, P2, in professional cycling. I've noticed Paul Sexas has started doing it as well. Remco Evenepoel was the first. The guys I blame, do you know who I blame? I love the guys at Lanterne Rouge. I think they do a fantastic podcast, fantastic product, but I think they were the first.
Saying P1
in professional cycling.
I've got
cycling.
A lot of guys, of teammates and colleagues.
Oh, really?
They are doing Grand Fondos. And they're saying P137.
Oh, my God. It started after Drive to Survive. It was very noticeable after the first series of Drive to Survive. People started saying it in professional cycling. It needs to be eradicated.
One niche fact about Formula One again. The statue I mentioned before is about William Grover, just down Santa Devote.
So not Ayrton Senna. Not, is this the Ayrton Senna one? No, different one.
Another one, yeah.
Okay. Pelacci, let's talk about some other performances today. And again, it was a really interesting course because we saw, do you know what we saw a lot of today? We saw a lot of riders, and sometimes these references, these sort of parallels or associations with people's mountain biking past, they're a little bit trite. I mean, okay, a guy was a good mountain biker 15 years ago. It doesn't mean that he's necessarily, you know, a certain type of rider now. However, having said that, there were riders with cyclocross pedigree, mountain biking pedigree, and a couple of riders did reference this in their interviews after the finish today, that in terms of sprinting out of corners and the technical nature of the course, I'm thinking of the likes of Callum Thornley, who started as a mountain biker on the Glen Tress trails in Scotland. Believe it or not, I've ridden those trails. Yeah, I've ridden those trails. Yeah, I did a couple of times. I've ridden a mountain bike about 3 times in my life, and I did it with Richard Moore. He introduced me to those trails. It was a sort of an annual thing. We used to go up to the Braveheart dinner in Scotland, which is a fundraising dinner for Scottish cyclists. And on the day before, we would ride these Glen Tress trails. This is a huge sort of area, forest and kind of mountains, hills, mountains, in the borders of Scotland, Pelacci. And that is where Callum Thornley started riding his bike. So he's a former mountain biker. Christophe Laporte is a former mountain biker. Léo Bizot, who was sixth, he's a very, very good cyclocross rider. So who knows, Pelacci? Maybe it's not all a load of old bunkum after all.
Daniele, it's fun. I think we'll talk about Léo Bizot a lot in this Vuelta a España. L'Equipe had an article the other day that said, did you like Paul Sexas at the Tour de France? You will love Léo Bizot at the Vuelta.
I saw that.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled for the guy.
Yes, Pelacci. He's one of the riders who I expect to maybe be one of the breakthrough stories of this Vuelta a España. I don't know whether it's going to be in as a GC rider. Obviously, he's got responsibilities vis-a-vis Felix Gall, who had a shocker today. But I think he's going to do well. Very good climber, very good all-rounder, in fact. A bit of a sort of Sexas light. That sounds slightly pejorative, but a very talented rider. Pelacci, I'm worried now. You've got me worried about these GC riders and how much time they lost. I didn't necessarily notice it this afternoon, because some of these guys went off pretty early, likes of Skelmoser, Gal. Skelmoser, we didn't mention how much time he'd lost.
Skelmoser was 40th. He lost 29 seconds.
A bit more than I expected. We know he's a very good time trialist, but not necessarily suited to a course like today's. But over 9 kilometres, okay, we've only got one more time trial down in, which is around, was it 30 kilometres, 32 kilometres from memory?
Yep.
In Jerez de la Frontera, in Andalusia, in week 3. So a lot of these guys can put away their time trial bike and forget about it for 2.5 weeks. However, that was time that they wouldn't have wanted to lose. They were always going to lose a little bit. As for Primoz Roglic, the enigma kind of wrapped in the riddle, wrapped in the mystery that is Primoz Roglic. Now, we know that he had a bit of an accident, 2 or 3 weeks before the start of the Vuelta a España. We heard a little bit more about that today, didn't we? He was up in Livigno, and he was sort of at the border crossing up there. Livigno sort of sits at, well, on the border of Switzerland, close to the border of Switzerland. And he'd sort of stopped at the border, the toll booth, and a car had basically hit him from behind. I think he posted on Instagram some pictures of some pretty heavy bruising on his right thigh. He couldn't really train for a couple of days thereafter, 2 or 3 days thereafter. Couldn't do much for a week or so after that. But we heard that for 4 or 5 days now, this week, he's actually been able to train normally. But he obviously lost a lot. We wondered whether he would be very fresh today. And again, a guy with local knowledge. He lives over, I understand, Pelacci, he lives over, as does Tadej Pogacar, as do all the Slovenians, I think, who live here, Slovenian cyclists. They live over the Monaco Vecchio side. Did the course, I think it covered pretty much the whole of the principality today, didn't it? Or a lot of the principality. Yeah, it did go over there. But anyway, he's apparently been feeling okay for 4 or 5 days, but obviously had lowered his expectations of this Vuelta a España. Also heard a little bit about his contract situation today or his future. Well, we didn't hear much. We heard that that is sort of all on hold at the moment. He wants to concentrate on the Vuelta a España, so don't expect any news about where Primoz Roglic is going to ride in 2027 during this Vuelta a España. But actually, what's your hunch, what's your feeling, what's your intuition about how Roglic is going to be in this Vuelta a España?
I think he's having a good time, Daniele. He was laughing after the finish line. I think he was...
Well, it's always that. That is Primoz Roglic.
Kind of true. He said in a press conference before the Vuelta a España, he said, my big ass saved me, huh? That was fun. I think given
Primoz
how...
Primoz will do Primoz.
He's not going to change. But I think the main problem with him is the fact that if, for stage 18, he's fourth, fifth, he's going to give the... He doesn't care about a podium over the Vuelta a España, right? He doesn't care about fifth at the Vuelta. He's going all in for the win. And as we saw at Tour de France a couple of years ago, maybe last year, if he is in that sort of middle position, he's going to go for it on a breakaway, on a crazy attack, on a... So, I don't know, probably his chances are not...
I didn't speak to any of the management at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe today, but maybe we will in the coming days, just because there are those who have seen their team selection at this Vuelta a España as a bit of a vote of no confidence for Primoz Roglic, in the sense that he doesn't have a lot of support here. He doesn't have mountain domestiques. They haven't picked the kind of team that, at the start of the year, if you'd said to me Primoz Roglic is going to target the Vuelta a España, I might have picked out 3 or 4 guys who would nominally have been not direct supporting, who would have been domestiques for him. And they haven't done that. They seem to have picked a team who, a lot of individuals who will have their own agendas here. So that doesn't augur particularly well. And Roglic, unfortunately, well, we talked there about his demeanour, which we've seen and we've enjoyed. We find him funny and good-humoured a lot of the time, very enigmatic, though. You don't necessarily know what he's thinking, what he's feeling. We've enjoyed that over the years. However, in a situation like this one, it can occasionally seem as though he doesn't care and he's sort of thrown in the towel. We had this in the Tour de France a couple of years ago where he made this throwaway remark about, I don't care anymore, or I couldn't care less, or something like that, something along those lines. And we all took it, or a lot of people took it, much more literally than I think he meant it, but it doesn't necessarily look great vis-a-vis his team management, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's not going to renew at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, so it's not as though he's sort of staking his future on what he's going to say in interviews, or his future with that team anyway. But in terms of selling himself and convincing people, convincing everyone that he's still got a lot to give as a winner, maybe he wants to revise his communication style.
But it's interesting, as you said, he has no mountain domestiques aside from these two young chaps and Finn Fisher-Black, Luke Tuckwell, or Callum Thornley, maybe, but Dani Martinez, not here. Vlasov, not here. Pellizzari, not here. Jai Hindley, not here. Remco, of course not.
There's no one.
What would you hope to see from Primoz Roglic at this Vuelta a España? What would be the sort of heartwarming denouement to the Roglic love affair with the Vuelta a España?
Interesting. Probably some fighting spirit. The old lion fighting his way to a podium, a second place.
I'd like to see him out sprinting Pogacar on a mountaintop, Roglifying Pogacar one last time.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah.
But then, wouldn't you have the doubt, did Pogacar leave him the win?
I suppose that's true. Pellacci, Primoz Roglic's career arc, you can never really predict the career arc of a rider. And there are always theories about, so-and-so, he came to cycling. This was something that was often said about Primoz Roglic, that he'd come to cycling late, obviously from ski jumping. You knew that, didn't
course,
you? He used to be a
course.
Ski jumper. And people said, consequently, his motivation is going to last longer than a rider who has been doing sort of junior races since they were under nines. I think this is also hogwash. This is another theory that doesn't hold up to any, doesn't withstand any scrutiny. But it's interesting that Roglic seems to have declined quite rapidly in the last few months. Now, there might be other reasons for that. Who knows? He might not be happy at Red Bull, or there might be health problems we don't know about. But this brings to mind another rider who we're about to talk about, Julien Alaphilippe, who finally announced, after L'Equipe had announced it earlier, but announced yesterday, wasn't it, that he is going to conclude his professional, well, he has concluded already his professional career at 34 years of age. Roglic is 37. But Alaphilippe is another rider who, particularly this year, actually last year, his first year at Tudor wasn't too bad in the sense that he almost won a Tour de France stage. He won the GP Quebec, not in the sort of classic Alaphilippe style, but he won it. But he has had quite a sharp decline as well. Now, today, we were keen to find out a little bit more about this announcement. Did it come out of the blue for Tudor Pro Cycling? We heard a couple of things on the way to the start today, which suggested it was a huge surprise for Tudor Pro Cycling. We wondered whether they would confirm that. Now, we heard Larry talk about it, allude to it after the finish earlier. We also heard him allude to Fabian Cancellara not liking my questions. Pellacci, you were there. My questions were perfectly innocuous, weren't they?
What did you do, Daniele? What are you doing here?
I don't know. Didn't like the cut of my jib. I don't know. For Cancellara, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say we go way back.
Fabian,
but
if you're listening, Fabian,
yeah.
Tomorrow we'll talk again.
Yeah. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll never talk again. Maybe even Larry will start shunning us. Anyway, today's Encuentro del Día, today's meeting of the day, is with Fabian Cancellara, and it is almost exclusively about Julien Alaphilippe.
El encuentro del día. The meeting of the day.
Tell me, I mean, how much of a surprise, how much did you know? And tell me a bit about the last few days.
On the end is everyone's own decision, and I think, like he mentioned already, that he thinks about. And I think on the end, it's a life of an athlete that one day this comes, for a few early, for a few later. And life after cycling is much, much, much longer than a normal life. And I mean, we are super proud, super happy to have had him with us, and there's no bad feeling, actually. I've been in this situation. I also retired in a different way, but the challenge, however you stop, it is always a challenge. And we are here and we support, and now we look forward, whatever thing that comes. But he added a lot of nice value, and he's a super good person. And cycling has changed. You know, cycling is not easy, and he's kind of this, not old generation, but this kind of, and it's, you know, there's a lot that has been demanded, and that's also with the whole nutrition. I mean, there's so many things, and now it's like this, and let's now look forward.
When he said at the Tour de France, Alpe d'Huez, I don't think you'll see me again to us journalists, did you already have an idea that maybe that would be, could possibly be his last race?
You know, when, I mean, of course, maybe the Tour was a I'll call it, maybe the Tour was not a realizing of its potential like this, or it will maybe be like this, but you know, the Tour is different than also a day two after the Tour, and that's why I think it's on the end everyone owns his own choice to say yes or no when it comes, and he will be loved forever, and whatever he did big things for cycling, and but like you see, it goes on. This world goes on, but his life will stop in a different way, in a new way, and family. I mean, there's so many other things around that he can explore. That today's cycling, it's much, much harder to enjoy kind of also this other side, because it's been demanding, it's high demanding, but a young guy that comes up, he comes in differently than his generation, or like a guy like Trentin or Haller, I mean, you know, but everyone else, everyone is different, you know. There's not good and not bad.
And just relative to your expectations, how would you assess his time at Tudor? Obviously the first year he won Quebec, almost won a Tour stage, but generally, relative to your expectations, how was his
time?
Tudor.
Well, you know, we had ambition in the Giro, Tour, Vuelta. We have ambition. We want to grow. We want to fulfill also our performance expectation. And I mean, if it's bad luck or not, I mean, of course, Fuchs said, "Oh, you had bad luck." Yeah, we had bad luck. We had a lot of injury, a lot of riders been not in a shape or sick or broken bones, and this is just our reality we faced for those few months, and that's why also I don't say we have been behind the schedule, but maybe behind a bit certain expectation, but I think we ended the Tour in a nice way. We started good in Burgos and also in Poland, and now they are back racing in Germany with Mark. We saw Trentin, we saw Moza, we saw now today here we hope for Stefan and also in generally, but that's sport. One day you win, one day you lose, one day you up, one day you down. I think this is just what I experienced, so I try to bring patience, because cycling is made of patience and not just about pushing the button and then you can roll, because we need to understand our riders, we need to understand our people, because a rider that is today and then he has a new girlfriend, he's still the same rider, but he has a different situation. He splits with the girlfriend, or his grandma died, or he moves away from home somewhere, and this is also where the young generation is now really on this, that on the end they're always human, so every situation is different, because training, recovery, I mean, many, many things around, and that's why I think it's a challenging, I don't say sport, but it's just a challenge that everyone is facing, you know.
So, very last thing, is it too late to, presumably you've got a bit more money now, a little bit more money to spend for next year, is it? Are there enough riders on the transfer market to still be able to spend that money?
We have Arnaud now, and we're already super proud that a rider like this has chosen us, and we build our building in Switzerland. So this will be a next milestone that cycling has never seen in Switzerland, also for whole sports landscape Switzerland. And but it's too fresh to say, yes, we just now go on the market. But which months we have? Huh?
Which months? What, before
we're
next season?
End of the season. So you see, and we did our hirings always early, and I mean, it's not about the money, it's about fulfill, and if you don't have the things you need, why you need to fill the roster just to fill a place? I think we're always open, but I think the market is quite done at the moment. When you see everything that Howard has moved. And I think we need also to stabilize our team, because when you have an organization like this and then you change too many riders, it's also to integrate them and to learn who we work, how we work. And I think there's much more that can come, but maybe it's also a year of stabilizing, and then you can make for 28.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote with in seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.
This is Jenny Garth from 90210 OMG. HGTV is bringing back the 90s in a big way with Totally 90s House, a brand new renovation competition series that reunites some of your favorite television stars from the era for a showdown unlike anything you've seen before. Let's be honest, the 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. But the home design choices, well, that's a different story. Hosted by Jaleel White, this throwback competition sends two teams of your favorite 90s TV stars across America in search of homes frozen in time. Their mission? Find the two most dated houses they can and transform them into modern dream homes. Jodi Sweetin, Beverly Mitchell, Brian Austin Green team up against Matthew and Joey Lawrence, Melissa Joan Hart, and Keisha Knight Pulliam. Paired with HGTV mentors, they'll transform those outdated spaces into fresh, modern homes while keeping just the right amount of dope, nostalgic charm. Goodbye, honey oak cabinets, sponge-painted walls, and glass blocks. Hello, 21st century dream homes. Totally 90s House special series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 Central on HGTV.
Pelachi, everything is wonderful, and every day the countryside is more beautiful. I'm enchanted by this place.
This is what the great Claude Monet used to say, right?
That was me ad-libbing.
Oh, really?
That was what Monet said. Pelachi, where are we? We need to really concentrate hard on giving the listeners some context, because it's a bit strange that we are where we are.
It is, because we are in the Riviera di Ponente, Liguria's west side, very close to the border with France, and also close to where the Vuelta a España is starting in Monaco. It's part of Italy, that's very far west, that's not very visited by the general public, but it's beautiful. And Bordighera, where we're staying, is beautiful.
So, we are specifically now, Pelachi, in the Giardini Monet. Claude Monet, the famous French painter, of course, impressionist painter. And we expected a beautiful scene, maybe beautiful water lilies in this park, knowing that it was dedicated to Claude Monet, but not really the case. It's a bit scruffy, isn't it? This little park in Bordighera. Why is there a park in Bordighera dedicated to Monet?
Because in the 19th century, in the 80s of the 19th century, this famous, famous painter had spent 79 days here, and Daniele, this brother, this chap, painted down 38. He was cooking in Bordighera.
That's the kind of productivity I want to see from you on this Vuelta a España for the Sucking podcast. Bordighera, even before we arrived here yesterday, it is a beautiful spot overlooking the Med. I knew one other thing about Bordighera. I knew there was an association with another famous sports person, not Tadej Pogacar, a world-leading sports person. Yannick Sinner used to live here. Why did he used to live here?
Because as soon as he quitted, it's pretty famous in Italy, he was a star, young star in alpine skiing, but then he quit the sport. He was very promising in alpine skiing as well, but then he picked up a tennis racket and said, hey, I'm good at this sport as well. I'm going down to Riccardo Piatti's academy, an illustrious coach here in the Bordighera outskirts towards Ventimiglia. And Yannick Sinner, in this academy, spent 7 years founding his, we can say, he's number one right now in the world, tennis player. So
we talk about him a lot, don't we? Because we talk about the fact that Italy is innamorata, in love with tennis at the moment and not cycling. And Sinner has replaced, he sort of evokes memories of Pantani in the late 90s.
And it's interesting because now, number one player is from Italy, Yannick Sinner. Number two is Carlos Alcaraz from Spain. But in the up-and-coming US Open, Carlos Alcaraz will be playing, Sinner will not. Mm. So there's a duel there.
Well, actually, yesterday I was reading about this period that Yannick Sinner spent in Bordighera, and I came across this quote. I was 13 and a half years old, and the truth is that as soon as I got there, I started crying. I called my parents after 2 hours, and they must have thought, here we have to go and get him. Initially, when I read that, I thought that was a quote from Michele Pellacci about being dropped off for the Vuelta a España with the cycling podcast. Pellacci, that was a little taste of our adventures in Bordighera. Heading back there very shortly. Yep. Hopefully, we're in time to still get dinner. We're not quite in Spain yet, therefore we can't pitch up at a restaurant at 11 o'clock and expect to get dinner. But 10 o'clock in Italy is usually all right, isn't it?
It's fine. Yep.
Not in France. Definitely not in France. We'd already be fuori tempo massimo, as you would say. We would already be outside the time limit in France, and it's currently 8:56, to give the listeners a little peek behind the cycling podcast curtain of when we are actually recording. Now, Pellacci, over the next 3 weeks, since it was so successful at the Giro d'Italia, our interactive third part of the podcast, we're going to continue with that, and we're going to give the listeners a chance to ask whatever questions they have for us relating to the Vuelta or not over the next 3 weeks. At the Giro, we invited these questions in the most haphazard way imaginable. We said, just contact us somehow. We don't care how, whether it's on Strava, whether it's
Instagram,
and it broadly worked. We were a bit disorganized, but it worked. Now, Lionel, I think during the Tour de France, he premiered a much more successful, much more high-tech solution. However, in our rush to start recording today, I haven't quite got to grips with this system yet, but I will hopefully be premiering that in turn for the Vuelta coverage tomorrow. In anticipation of that, just send in your questions however you want for today, for the next 48 hours, and you're in the lottery, you're in the hat. We might pick your question out and we might answer it here on the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España. Pellacci, of course, the Vuelta only starts today, so we've not had any questions so far. So we thought we'd kick off the interactive section of the podcast by asking each other one question. So, Pellacci, what's your question to me?
Mine is pretty Vuelta related because there are five riders here who were born in the 80s. Who are them, Daniele?
Who are... am I allowed to use the World Wide Web for this, Pellacci?
We've been talking about one. A lot.
Larry.
Recently. It's not Larry.
Is Larry born in the 90s?
In 1990. Okay. Precisely.
I don't know, Pellacci. I'm also not convinced that this makes great podcasting. Me just sitting here sort of scratching my chin for the next 15 minutes wondering. Stefan Kung?
Nope. So they are Steven Kruijswijk, the oldest rider at the Vuelta. David de la Cruz, Rudy Molar, Primoz Roglic, and Mikel Landa. They are the five.
Interesting. Sort of interesting. sort of not. Pellacci, I'm going to ask you a question about recent news. We heard a couple of days ago that we think the Vuelta a España is going to start from Sardinia, from your homeland. Again, that will be the second start in Italy. I mean, we're staying in Italy in this one, so it's kind of, for us, it's kind of two Gran Salidas in succession, but it might be the third in, well, the second in 3 years if it starts in Sardinia. There are historical links between Sardinia, the Kingdom of Sardinia, and Catalunya. But what do you make of this?
It's so interesting. I think the Vuelta a Catalunya started in Sardinia in 1987.
Sean Kelly, I think Sean Kelly won that.
Correct.
Year. Yeah.
That is fantastic, but the Giro d'Italia has not been in Sardinia.
That seems absolutely absurd since 2017.
Exactly. So what are we doing here, Sardinia? What's going on?
Well, yeah, I would like to ask the government. I mean, if they are listening, the government of Sardinia. Listen, what are you playing at,
Daniele? The government of Sardinia. I like them. Generally, when they were elected, in 2 years, there's a woman in charge who I like. Again, she has been tried to stop anything that's related to renewable energy in Sardinia. That's unconstitutional, the court says in Italy. So something very odd is going on in Sardinia. But apparently they'll be hosting the Vuelta a España in 2 years.
I cannot imagine any good possible reason for them to bid for the Vuelta a España as opposed to the Giro d'Italia. I mean, the Giro d'Italia, I'm sure, would be delighted to have them. The only thing I can think of is that they see this period of the year, this time of the year, as more congenial than May. But I doubt that somehow. I doubt that. But actually, you just reminded me of something. We were talking yesterday, I think at dinner, about the fact that this Vuelta a España finishes in Granada and it finishes Andalusia. It wasn't originally supposed to finish in Andalusia. It was supposed to finish in the Canary Islands. Now, this has been mooted for a long time. The Canary Islands have wanted the Vuelta, they've not wanted it. Then the Vuelta organization have wanted the race to go to the Canaries and they've not managed to do it. Finally, it looked as though in 2026 we're going to have the Gran Llegada, the end of the Vuelta in Gran Canaria, I think it was going to be. There were going to be two or three stages in the Canary Islands. They pulled out, the Canary Islands pulled out because of what happened in the last week of the Vuelta last year with the pro-Palestine protests and then everything sort of falling apart and being a bit shambolic on the last day. So the Vuelta had to look for another solution. The best solution they could come up with, they could find, was finishing in Andalusia. The race was going to travel from Andalusia to the Canaries anyway, so add on a couple of stages, finishing in Granada. Perfect solution. I was thinking earlier, you got the same press release and the same email as me. The Vuelta, I think today or yesterday, announced as one of their official sponsors, suppliers, the plátanos, the bananas of Gran Canaria or de las Canarias.
Sí, sí. And they're sponsoring the Premio de la Combatividad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, bananas for combativity. Daniele, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to say.
Interesting. We'll have a conversation one day about the Vuelta a España official mascots over the years. That's a subject I will introduce,
Daniele,
one day.
We've got some stuff coming up because the mascot of UCI Monaco, an elephant named Booba, and the mascot of the Vuelta, a bull named Tay-Tay.
Tay-Tay, yeah.
They were teaming up today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were having fun together.
A bit of a romantic trip. Keep it clean, Alachi. Right, let's talk about tomorrow's stage.
La etapa de mañana y asuntos varios. Tomorrow's stage and any other business.
Pelachi, a small tweak to programming, to usual programming this year on the Vuelta a España. We've sort of canned, I've decided, I took the executive decision to can the part within the part about yesterday's dinner, because I particularly, and I take responsibility for this, I'm not very good at it and I often forget, and I'm not very focused on what we eat at dinner.
So is very good at this.
He's very good at it. So we will often still talk about yesterday's dinner, but I've opened a window of opportunity for us to talk about other things as well. This will become more relevant as the days go by. We haven't got too much to add, I don't think. We wanted to keep it brief tonight.
Yeah.
So we're not going to talk about too much tonight, although we can briefly mention last night's dinner.
Well, yeah, it was fantastic. I had a basically hyper-powered carbonara that was fantastic.
We had some typical Ligurian, some real local specialities. What we had, farinata. Tell the listeners
farinata,
about farinata. What's farinata? What?
You're pretending me to explain a pretty complicated dish in English.
It's a chickpea pancake.
Oh, of course.
And then what was the other thing? It was like a samosa. Do you know what a samosa is? That's Indian cuisine, but it wasn't spicy. the sort of, what was Boudou, what was it called? Boudou, you couldn't even pronounce it. What was it? Boo.
It was really complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Everything was fantastic though, and
little sort of pastry parcels.
Oh yeah, you had a
beautiful spinach in, didn't they? Yeah.
Terrace on the Ligurian coast. That was fantastic. I want to go back.
Well, you're going back in about half an hour if we wrap up this recording. Okay, tomorrow's stage. We are starting in the Principality again. It is taking the riders from Monaco to Manosque in Provence. It's a fairly hilly-looking profile, Pelacci. However, the general consensus seems to be that we're going to get a sprint of some description tomorrow. Maybe a sprint that someone like Wout van Aert or Matthew Brennan might contest for Visma Lisa bike, or indeed Mads Pedersen. Mads Pedersen might also be interested in getting a break tomorrow. There are those who suggest that this uphill finish, which features in the Étoile de Bessège, I think it's often, or is it the Tour de la, not Tour de la Provence? This same finish has featured on numerous occasions and Mads Pedersen has won there, but there are those who suggest that Tadej Pogacar could also win tomorrow. Pelacci, I just wanted to mention, I mentioned this in the preview, Manosque is very famous as the birthplace and resting place, if I'm not mistaken, of a French writer called Jean Giono. Pelacci, Giono, particularly early in his career, wrote a lot about the natural world, sort of man after my own heart, man after our own heart, because we're both lovers of the natural world. Outside France, his best known work is probably the short story The Man Who Planted Trees. And he died in 1970. He was once honoured by the Prince of Monaco Literary Prize. That was in 1953. So there's a little link with Monaco. He was nicknamed Le Voyageur Immobile, the Motionless Traveller, because he spent pretty much all of his life in Manosque. But he had a sort of endless appetite for discovering new things about Manosque. So he never stopped travelling, but within the confines of Manosque.
Can't wait, Daniele, to go to Provence tomorrow, in a region I don't know.
About Eric Carritu. I was telling you about him earlier. And we talked about close margins today, didn't we?
Yeah,
close margins.
You're correct.
The 10/900th of a second that Tadej Pogacar won the red jersey of the Vuelta a España by today. Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about a Vuelta a España that was won by 6 seconds.
Wow.
By Eric Carritu, a Frenchman who's from Provence, who has a winery in Provence, close to the finish, close to Manos tomorrow.
That's fantastic. Can't wait. See you tomorrow.
Grazie, Michele.
Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.